I have a sense of optimism and despair, a feeling of tiredness and hope, all at the same time, perhaps because I'm half drunk.
Accept that added profession of being an activist, because I think that reduces what writers used to be. All writers, not all writers, but many writers write about the world they live in without needing to be called activists. That's a very new word, and that word has been added on because the idea of what a writer is in the world today has been reduced into a commodity. You know, you're supposed to be an entertainer who lives between literature festivals and bestseller lists or something. So for me, I would just say that, you know, the world is very busy classifying and codifying and putting people into silos. And it's especially today, you know, when majoritarianism is on the rise, it's our job to be unpopular. You know, it's our job to stand alone and say what we really think, not as activists, but as writers.
Let me mention one small disappointment. I wish that at this forum there was a greater representation on the last day of this long teaching of women, of black people, and of Indians on this panel than there actually was.
Well, it was more than that. I had to do a lot of research because you never know anybody, even if you're very close, especially somebody as complicated as Iqbal was. There are layers upon layers upon layers.
Because in Algeria, I couldn't be a Pakistani. As in America, I couldn't be an Algerian. And in Pakistan, I can't be an American. So you know the complications of life.
And we wrote together. We're activists together, we did a lot of things together, but you never know anybody fully. And if you're writing a biography, you better know a lot. And I didn't know enough when I began.
The UN must grapple every day. When David asked him about the choices he had made in his life, his reply was as follows. I had two choices. I could have lived a very comfortable, boring, selfish, quiet existence as a regular academic or a corporate executive. Instead, I chose to live a life that has been very rich spiritually and intellectually and rather poor materially. I have the simple satisfaction of knowing that we have tried, did the best we could, did not always succeed, but tried to change where change seemed necessary. I'm very honored to introduce Professor Ahmed.
Thank you very much for those very generous introduction. But I want to tell the audience not to be fooled by such introductions. Just before I came up here, they gave me a watch and asked me to speak for not more than 55 minutes. David Barsamian also instructed me to tell the audience to boo at me if I cross the 55-minute limit. I would suggest that you do the booing after 60 minutes. It reminds me to, first of all, tell you a story. I'm a storyteller. 1961, I went to Cuba under an assumed name with an Algerian delegation. We met with Castro. He received us for breakfast. That was the 26th of July. And he treated us most graciously. And around 12:30, and he said, comrades, you are coming with me to the 26th July celebrations. Comrade, it won't be very long. I am a man of few words, said Fidel Castro. We went with him, we followed him. He spoke for 6.5 hours. I am a man of few words too. I hope you have brought your sleeping bags. No, but seriously speaking, they have asked me to speak on terrorism. And they gave it a very good title, which is not mine. What's the title? It's Theirs and Ours, or something like that. But actually, the title that I was given is uncannily close to what I want to talk about, which is two views of terrorism, theirs and mine, because a third doesn't exist. Terrorists are typically shy of giving reasons for their terrorism beyond a cause. If they are very intelligent and belong to a minority group, they explain that they have a cause. The rest do not describe a cause. Therefore, the analysis of terrorism comes from two sources. Those who claim to oppose it and those who try to explain it. Those are the two sources. These are ideologically loaded words, terrorists and terrorism. First, a small bit of history. In the 17th, 18th and 19th century, if you look at historical literature in English and Spanish, you will find references to Indian terrorists. The Indians they are referring to are not the ones from where I come. They are the ones from where Chandu comes. Where is Chandu? Shoot your arrow, show yourself. Then they are referring, in other words, to the indigenous peoples of the southern hemisphere who were resisting their dispossession and what would turn out to be their ultimate destruction. In the late 18th and early, rather throughout the 19th centuries, you get this word in English literature and in English journalism. By English I mean belonging to England, with reference to the thugs, T-H-U-G-S, a word that has entered into the English language as a synonym of terrorist, thugs. And thuggy, which was in the 19th century a synonym of terrorism. If you look at Oxford English Dictionary, you will find the synonyms even today. Thugs, thuggy, terrorist, terrorism. Thugs, historians of South Asia among you will recall, was a religious grouping, movement, of low-caste Hindus and Muslims who dedicated themselves to committing crimes against the establishment of British rule on India. And they really have become terrorists for all time. It's only in recent years that this subaltern group of subaltern studies that came out of Delhi school and now has spread all over the place. Its founder is now teaching in Australia. A subaltern group has now been depicting the Thuggee movement as essentially an anti-colonial movement that was typed as a criminal conspiracy. Then more interesting things happen. In the 1930s and 1940s, the Jewish underground in Palestine was described as quote-unquote terrorist. Then new things happen. By 1942, Holocaust was occurring, and a certain liberal sympathy with the Jewish people had built up in the Western world. At that point, the terrorists of Palestine, who were Zionists, the terrorists of Palestine suddenly started to be described by 1944-45 as freedom fighters. At least two Israeli prime ministers, including Menachem Begin, had actually, you can find in the books, posters with their pictures saying terrorist and prize this much. The highest prize I have noted so far was 100,000 British pounds on the head of Menachem Begin, the terrorist.
In Palestine, terrorists strike again. The petrol storage installation at Haifa was set on fire. Damage and loss is estimated at £350,000. The Palestine government has stated that the cost of the outrage must be borne by the Jewish community. Ten storage tanks were destroyed. The whole town of Haifa lay under a dense pall of smoke. 2,000 troops and six army fire brigades fought for 24 hours to bring the blaze under control.
Then in 1969 and 1969 to 1990, the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, occupied the center stage as the terrorist organization. Yasser Arafat has been described repeatedly by the great sage of American journalism, I'm referring to William Safire of the New York Times, as the chief of terrorism. That's Yasser Arafat. Now, on September 29, 1998, I was rather amused, not quite happy, to notice a picture of Yasser Arafat to the right of President Bill Clinton, and to his left is the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is known as Mr. Yahoo all over the Middle East. And Clinton is looking towards Arafat, and Arafat is looking literally like a meek mouse. And just a few years earlier, he used to appear with this very menacing look around him, with a gun appearing menacing from his belt. You remember those pictures, and you remember the next one. I should go on. In 1985, end of 85, beginning of 86, I can't remember the dates, President Ronald Reagan used to be the President of the United States. Once Hollywood, then White House. President Ronald Reagan received a group of bearded men. These bearded men I was writing about in those days. At the moment, I was preparing to write about them in the New Yorker. Actually did. They were very ferocious-looking bearded men with turbans and tall, kind of looking like they came from another century. And President Reagan received them in the White House. They were at that time, guns in hand, battling the evil empire.
I have spoken on occasion of the presence of unsung heroes in American life. Today we recognize a nation of unsung heroes whose courageous struggle is one of the epics of our time. The Afghan people have matched their heroism against the most terrifying weapons of modern warfare in the Soviet arsenal. Despite blanket bombing and chemical and biological weapons, the brave Afghan freedom fighters have prevented the nearly 100,000 strong Soviet occupation force from extending its control over a large portion of the countryside. We cannot and will not turn our backs on this struggle.
In 1998, September, another American president ordered missile strikes from the American Navy based in the Indian Ocean, ordered missile strikes to kill Osama bin Laden and his men in the camps in Afghanistan. I do not wish to embarrass you with a reminder that Mr. bin Laden, whom the American 15 American missiles were fired to hit in Afghanistan, was only a few years ago the moral equivalent of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. He got angry over the fact that he has been demoted from moral equivalent of your founding fathers. So he is taking out his anger in different ways. I'll come back to that subject more seriously in a minute. You see, why I have recalled all this story is to merely point out to you that the matter of terrorism is rather complicated, and terrorists change faster than the greenback does, much faster, in the game of high politics, in which the stake is an empire and the counters are people. So the terrorist of yesterday is the hero of today, and the hero of yesterday becomes the terrorist of today. This is a serious matter of constantly changing world of images in which we have to keep our heads straight to know what is terrorism and what is not. But more importantly, to know what causes it and how to stop it. Next point about our terrorism is that posture of inconsistency necessarily evades definition. If you are not going to be consistent, you're not going to define. It's a simple principle all students must learn, do learn, or if they don't, ought to learn when they write a paper. If you are serious about it, define yourself. Define your topic. Define your subject. Then proceed to explicate it. If you are not defining, you are evading. You are trying to run away. You are trying to cheat me. You are trying to get a good grade without having done your work. And that's the truth. Every teacher knows that. Now, have you noticed, in preparation for this evening, I have examined at least 20 official documents on terrorism. Not one defines the word. Not one defines the word. All of them explain it, express it emotively, polemically, to arouse our emotions rather than exercise our intelligence. I'll give you only one example which is representative. October 25th, 1984, George Shultz, then Secretary of State of the United States of America, is speaking at the New York Park Avenue Synagogue, a long speech on terrorism. 7 in the State Department bulletin, 7 single space pages, not a single definition of terrorism. What we get is the following quotations. Terrorism is a modern barbarism that we call terrorism. Definition number one. Definition number two is even more brilliant. Terrorism is a form of political violence. Aren't you surprised? It is a form of political violence, says George Shultz, Secretary of State of the United States of America. Number three, terrorism is a threat to Western civilization. Number four, terrorism is a menace to Western moral values. Did you notice? Does it tell you anything other than arouse your emotion? Typically, this is typical. Officials and academic functionaries, that is, those who work for officials, you know whom I am speaking of, people like Henry Kissinger, they have always worked for officials. They're academics. I have to tell you a story. Henry Kissinger was always consulting, seldom took his classes at Harvard. He had research assistants. Harvard has research assistants. Harvard is full of graduate students who are research assistants, right? So Kissinger records his speeches on a tape recorder. All his voice is available on the tape recorder. Then his assistants play his lectures to the classes and then take questions and answer questions and lead answers, etc., etc. One day he missed his plane or whatever happened. He arrived, Kissinger. He approaches the classroom, arrives there. He hears his voice. He's happy. The tape is playing. He gets into the class. There is dead silence. He's happy. Nobody's talking. He's happy. He gets inside the class, looks around. The tape is playing, and 35 tapes are listening. Isn't that a great story? It's a pure Harvard story, I must say. I love Harvard. Anyway, what I'm saying is that they don't define terrorism because definitions involve a commitment to analysis, comprehension, and adherence to some norms of consistency. That's the second characteristic of the official literature on terrorism. The third characteristic is that the absence of definition does not prevent officials to be globalistic. We may not define terrorism, but it is a menace to the moral values of Western civilization. It is a menace also to mankind.
I'm Dara Brown at MSNBC World Headquarters in New York. We interrupt lockup to bring you Vice President Mike Pence's speech from the Munich Security Conference.
The world is now a more dangerous place than at any point since the collapse of communism a quarter century ago. The threats to our safety and security span the globe, from the rise of radical Islamic terrorism to the threats posed by Iran and North Korea and to many others who threaten our security and our way of life.
It's a menace to good order. Therefore, we must stamp it out worldwide. Our reach has to be global. You need a global reach to kill it. Anti-terrorist policies, therefore, have to be global. There is no question, quotations, same speech of George Shultz, there is no question about our ability to use force where and when it is needed to counter terrorism. There is no geographical limit. On a single day, the missiles hit Afghanistan and Sudan. Those two countries are 2,300 miles apart, and they were hit by navies belonging to a country roughly 8,000 miles away. The reach is global. Tough. In September 1998, I told you, they hit several thousand miles apart. A fourth characteristic. The claims of power are not only globalist, they are also omniscient. We know where they are, therefore we know where to hit. We have the means to know. We have the instruments of knowledge. We are omniscient. Quotation, Mr. George Shultz again, and then compare it with today's behavior. We know the difference between terrorists and freedom fighters, says Mr. George Shultz. We know the difference between terrorists and freedom fighters, and as we look around, we have no trouble telling one from the other. Court's closed.
This country plans to launch the third Columbia space shuttle. Just as the Columbia we think represents man's finest aspirations in the field of science and technology, so too does the struggle of the Afghan people represent man's highest aspirations for freedom. The fact that freedom is the strongest force in the world is daily demonstrated by the people of Afghan. Accordingly, I am dedicating on behalf of the American people the March 22nd launch of the Columbia to the people of Afghanistan.
So you see, only Osama bin Laden doesn't know that he is an ally one day, an enemy another. And that's very confusing for Osama bin Laden. I'll come back to his story towards the end, because it's a real story. 5. The officialist approach eschews causation. You don't look at causes of anybody becoming terrorist. Cause? What cause? Cause. They ask us to be looking, to be sympathetic to this. Another example. The New York Times, December 18, 1985, reported that the foreign minister of Yugoslavia, you remember the days when there was a Yugoslavia, foreign minister of Yugoslavia requested the Secretary of State of the United States to consider the causes of Palestinian terrorism. The Secretary of State, George Shultz, I'm quoting from the New York Times, went a bit red in the face. He pounded the table and told the visiting foreign minister, there is no connection with any cause. Period. Courts closed. Why look for causes? Number 6. The moral revulsion that we must feel from against terrorism is selective. We are to feel the terror of those groups which are officially disapproved. We are to applaud the terror of those groups of whom officials do approve. Hence, President Reagan again, I am a contra. He actually said that, I am a contra. You know, the contras of Nicaragua were anything by any definition but terrorists. The media, to move away from the officials, aids the dominant view of terrorism. In 1984, the Palestine Liberation Organization hijacked a tourist boat cruise in the Mediterranean waters. And as it held the passengers hostage, it found a Jewish passenger, Mr. Klinghoffer, a crippled old man, and those cruel Palestinian terrorists shot him and threw him off the board. Now, this is an atrocious, outrageous, condemnable, curseable offense, without doubt. It should have been condemned, and it was condemned. Editorials were written, comments were made, official statements were issued by governments after governments condemning this act, as it should have been. Then, 2 weeks later, Israeli terrorists killed a Palestinian American, or an Arab American, I'm not sure he was a Palestinian, named Alexander Odeh, in his office in Los Angeles. The news was reported. The murder was reported. I measured the report in the New York Times, 2 inches. I also measured the report of Mr. Klinghoffer's killing 140 inches. And Alexander Ode got almost no television reporting, except from LA itself. Then one day at Tufts University, I am speaking. From the other side is Jack Rosenthal, an editor of the New York Times. Don't confuse him with this Abe Rosenthal, who writes the columns and used to be, at that time, the managing editor of the New York, executive editor of the New York. So I asked Jack Rosenthal, I said, how can you describe one horror with 140 inches of reporting in one day and another horror of 2 inches of reporting? I want to tell you his answer. I'm quoting directly as I confronted Jack Rosenthal. His response, quote, it was a mistake. We recognize it. Let's move on. Since he was a powerful man, I had to move on. No choice. The dominant approach also excludes from consideration, more importantly to me, the terror of friendly governments. To that question I will return, because it excused, among others, the terrors of Pinochet, who killed one of my closest friends, Orlando Letelier. And it excused the terror of Ziaulhaq, who killed many of my friends in Pakistan. All I wanted to tell you is, according to my ignorant or vague calculations, the ratio of people killed by state terror of Ziaulhaq, Pinochet, Argentinian, Brazilian, Indonesian type, versus the killing of the PLO and other terrorist type, is literally, conservatively, 1 to 100,000. That's the ratio. So, next, my sixth point, or eighth point. History, unfortunately, recognizes and accords visibility to power and not to weakness. Therefore, visibility has been accorded historically to dominant groups. In our time, by our time I mean the time which began with this day, Columbus Day. The time that begins with Columbus Day is a time of extraordinary, unrecorded holocausts. Great civilizations have been wiped out. The Mayas, the Incas, the Aztecs, the American Indians, the Canadian Indians were all wiped out. And their voices have not been heard even to this fully. Now they are beginning to be heard, but not fully. They are heard, yes, but only when the dominant power suffers. Only when resistance has a semblance of costing, of exacting a price, when a Custer is killed or when a Gordon is besieged. That's when you know that there were Indians fighting, Arabs fighting and dying. My last point of this section. U.S. policy in the Cold War period has sponsored terrorist regimes one after another. Somozas, Batistas, all kinds of tyrants have been America's friends, and you know that. And there was a reason for that. I and you are not guilty. We can't consider ourselves guilty because partly we have never been even informed. We can say we did not know and say it honestly. Sometimes we did and protested. I will only take the period of the Cold War, that is, the one after World War II, without going into detail, identify to you three periods of American policy of varying degrees of support for terrorist states and terrorist groups. Those periods are 1945 to 56. During this period, the United States intervened on the side of tyrants. In 1953, a constitutional government in Iran was overthrown. Mohammad Mossadegh and a tyrant, the Shah of Iran, was brought back in.
Crown Prince Abdullah greets the Shah as he lands at Baghdad Airport after a 7-hour flight from Rome. Here he was to remain overnight as the guest of King Faisal before completing the journey to Tehran. Meanwhile, in Tehran itself, all stood ready to welcome the return of the Shah after the dramatic development in events which first compelled him to flee and then led to a royalist coup d'etat in which Mossadegh was arrested. Now, everywhere, supporters throng the streets proclaiming their loyalty to the Shah. General Zahedi, the new premier, emerges as the hero of the hour, for he it was who took charge of events and organized the movement that threw Mossadegh from power. The ruins of Mossadegh's residence bear witness to the fury of the mob, and the clash of conflicting loyalties is well illustrated by the damaged statue of the Shah's father. But now order is restored, and General Zahedi has the proud duty of proceeding to the airport to greet the returning sovereign. Later, in an interview granted to the international press, General Zahedi disclosed that he had formed his cabinet. And now with escort, the Shah arrives. It's greetings, cheers and flowers all the way for their monarch, who now faces the arduous task of putting his country's affairs in order.
A constitutionally elected government of Arbenz was overthrown. And a tyranny in Argentina Guatemala was brought in. Between Arbenz's fall and today, American estimates, now official estimates, are that 1/3 of the population of Guatemala has been killed by these tyrants whom CIA supported.
Peace comes to Guatemala. For the first time in 10 years, the people of Guatemala are breathing the sweet air of liberty. Only days after the resignation of Red President Jacobo Arbenz, rebel leader Castillo Armas sweeps into town. Thousands of communists and fellow travelers are rounded up in makeshift prisons. For United Fruit, it's business as usual, as all company land seized by the communists is returned. On television, Secretary of State Dulles announces the return of democracy to Guatemala.
The future of Guatemala lies at the disposal of the Guatemalan people themselves. It lies also at the disposal of leaders loyal to Guatemala who have not treasonably become the agents of an alien despotism which sought to use Guatemala for its own evil ends. The events of recent months and days add a new and glorious chapter to the already great tradition of the American states.
That's the first period, 56, ends. 1956 to 1975. Is a period of intervention. America, by military or paramilitary means, not just mere support for tyrant, by military or paramilitary means, directly goes in support of tyrants. The biggest one that you remember is Indochina, Vietnam, in support of totally unpopular regimes. And it ends that period I would call a period of counterinsurgency. First period, 45 to 56, interventions. Second period, 59 1956 to 1975, counterinsurgency. Ends with Vietnam. Period 3, 1958 to 1990. Low intensity warfare. Nicaragua, Contra. Afghanistan, Mujahideen. El Salvador, etc., etc. And now, 1990 to 98, the period that I only describe honestly as a period of confusion. After this Cold War, nobody knows what to do, how to be, how to justify, where to go, in which way to deal with the world. That is why you have so many theories coming in and going out, coming in. The theories of international relations are entering the American door like foxes, like foxes in a farmhouse. It's crazy. There was the first 6 months of end of history. What was his name? Francis Fukuyama says the history has ended. America has won. American victory spells the end of history. We don't have to do anything. Everybody was very happy. But then they discovered that there are problems. So there comes, who knows, Professor Samuel Huntington with Clash of Civilizations, straight out of Harvard. Clash of civilization. What is civilization? Clash of cultures, he says. Clash of civilizations, he says. 9 civilizations, he says. 6 civilizations, he names. Total confusion. But people think he has done something big. He lasts for almost 4 years, then he dies. He doesn't die, his theory dies. Confusion, confusion. Now President Clinton comes around and says, clash of civilization is bunk. We can do differently. Now, the second size. You've suffered enough, so suffer more. Ain't much good on the other side either. You shouldn't imagine that I have come to praise the other side. But keep the balance in mind. Keep the imbalance in mind and first ask ourselves, what is terrorism? Our first job should be to define the damn thing, name it, give it a description, some kind, other than moral equivalent of founding fathers or a moral outrage to Western civilization. I will stay with you with Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. Terror, says Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. You can all check back to it. Terror is an intense, overpowering fear. That's terror. And he uses terrorism, quote, the use of terrorizing methods, hear me closely, the use of terrorizing methods of governing or resisting a government. Quotes closed. This simple definition has one great virtue, and the virtue of fairness. It's fair. It focuses on the use of coercive violence. Violence that is used illegally, extra-constitutionally to coerce. That bloody red light in your city is also coercive. This is an extraordinary country. This country is, this whole West is terribly funny to me. You know, the first time I arrived here, I was driving on an empty road in Princeton, New Jersey, where I was going to school. In the middle of the night, 2 o'clock, I was a bit drunk, young man. I arrived at a red light, and there were 2 cars standing there. And I looked at them in wonder. Why are they standing here? And then the light turned green and they moved. I moved too. You see, in the middle of nowhere, the government's coercive the laws, coercive capability was present, and people obeyed. That's not terrorism. That's not coercion. I'm serious. That's consensus. To me, coercion, terror begins where consensus ends. Terror begins where democracy ends. Terror begins where agreement ends. You follow me? Therefore, I am talking about extra-constitutional, extra-legal, illegal coercion by government or by private organizations. That is terror. No question about it. And this definition is correct because it treats terror for what it is. Terror, whether government commits it or private people commit it. You see, notice something. Motivation is kept out of it. We're not talking about whether the cause is just or unjust. We're talking about consensus, consent, absence of consent, legality, absence of legality, constitutionality, absence of constitutionality. Those are the issues. Why do we keep motive out? Because motives differ. Motives differ and make no difference. I have identified in my work 5 types of terrorism. First, state terrorism. Second, religious terrorism. Terrorism inspired by religion. Catholics killing Protestants, Sunnis killing Shias, Shias killing Sunnis, everybody killing everybody in the name of God, religion. Sacred terror, you can call it. So there is a state, there is church, there is crime, mafia, all kinds of crime commits terror. There is pathology. You know, Bumble was pathological. You're sick. You want attention of the whole world. You gotta kill a president. You kill. You terrorize. You gotta hold a bus. You do it. And so there is pathology. And fifth, there is political terror of the private group. Be the Indian, the Vietnamese, the Algerian, the Palestinian, the Bader Meinhof, the Red Brigade, whichever that is. Political terror of the private group. The oppositional terror, I call it. Keep these in 5 in mind and begin to move on. Keep in mind one more thing. Sometimes these 5, any 2 or any 3 can converge on each other. You start with protest terror. You go crazy, you become pathological, you continue. Goes on. The weathermen started with political terror. They simply got crazy. I'm getting to be my 55 minutes, so I've got to finish fast. 10 minutes to go. Oh, how am I going to do it? See, they converge. State terror can take the form of private terror. For example, you're all familiar with it. The Death Squad in Latin America, or the Death Squad in Pakistan. And the government has employed private people to kill its opponents. So it's not quite official, it's privatized. You see what I'm saying? Convergence. Or the political terrorist who goes crazy and becomes pathological. Or the criminal who joins politics. All through in Afghanistan, in Central America, the CIA employed in its covert operations drug pushers. Drugs and guns often go together. Smuggling of all things go together. In fact, you can smuggle women, drugs and guns at the same time. And men too, if they are trying to migrate to the United States. Any number of convergences occur. But within that framework, please move on fast because I have little time. We have to move fast. You would notice that of the 5 types of terror, focuses on only one, the least important. The least important in terms of cost to human lives and human property. The highest cost, state terror. Second high cost, religious terror. Although in the 20th century, religious terror has, relatively speaking, declined. But if you are looking historically, massive costs. Next high cost, crime. Next high, pathology. A Rand Corporation study, a man called Brian Jenkins, for 10-year period up to 1988, showed 50% of terror was committed without any political cause at all. No politics, simply crime and pathology. This is Brian Jenkins' study. So move on to examine then the focus on only one, the political terrorists, the PLO, the Bin Laden, whoever you want to take, any number. Why do they do it? What makes the terrorist tick? Those, I would like to knock them out quickly to you. First, I'm looking for my damn notes, which are... Where are they? Did you steal my notes, dude? No, I'll come back to you, don't worry. I'm with you. I'm with you. I just mixed up pages. First, the need to be heard. Now, imagine we are dealing with the minority group, the political private terrorists. First, the need to be heard. Normally, and there are exceptions, there is an effort to be heard, to get your grievances heard by people. They are not hearing it. Then a minority acts and the majority applauds. The Palestinians, for example, the super terrorists of our time, were dispossessed in 1948. From 1948 to 1968, they went to every court in the world. They knocked at every door in the world. And they were told that they became dispossessed because some radio told them to go away, an Arab radio, which was a lie. Nobody was listening to the truth. Finally, they invented a new form of terror, literally their invention, the airplane hijacking. And between 1968 and 1975, they pulled the world from its ears. They dragged us out. Said, listen. Well, we listen. We still haven't done them justice. But at least we all know and acknowledge. Even the Israelis acknowledge. Remember Golda Meir in 1970, Prime Minister of Israel, saying, there are no Palestinians. They do not exist. Well, damn well they exist now. You are cheating them at Oslo. At least you are there some people to cheat now. You can't just push them out. So you see, the need to be heard is essential. One motivation there. Second, mix of anger and helplessness produces an urge to strike out. You are angry. You are feeling helpless. You want retributive. You want to wreak retributive justice. I want to quote somebody from you. You will see what I mean. I have pounded a few walls. I have pounded a few walls myself when I'm alone. Quote. I want to kick somebody in the rear end. Quotes close. The speaker is Ronald Reagan. After the TWA hijacking and America unable to solve the problem. Another example. They kept yelling about New Jersey. New Jersey, New Jersey, New Jersey. They kept saying New Jersey. I was afraid to tell them that I was from New Jersey. The speaker is Judy Brown from a small town called Delmar, New Jersey. She was one of the hostages taken by the Lebanese Shiites who hijacked the TWA plane in 1983. I was afraid to tell them where I was from. Why are they so mad at New Jersey? Judy Brown asked the newspaperman. The New York Times correspondent says that he informed Judy that they were not yelling about the state. They were yelling about the battleship New Jersey, which had pounded the Lebanese Shiite neighborhoods in Beirut for 7 days in a row, killing 1,000 people. And those kids were angry as hell. 3. Experience of violence by a stronger party has historically turned victims into terrorists. Battered children are known to become abusive parents and violent adults. You know that. That's what happens to peoples and nations. When they are battered, they get bad. State terror very often breeds collective terror. Do you recall the fact that the Jews were never terrorists? By and large, Jews were not known to commit terror, except during and after the Holocaust. Most studies show that majority of members of the worst terrorist groups in Israel or in Palestine, the Stern and the Irgun gangs, were people who were immigrants from the most anti-Semitic countries of Eastern Europe and Germany. Similarly, the young Shiites of Lebanon or the Palestinians from the refugee camps, these are battered people. Pounding the walls is a metaphor for internecine warfare, for internal violence. They become very violent. The ghettos are violent internally. They become violent externally when there is a clear, identifiable external target, an enemy they can say, yes, this one did it to me. Then they can strike back. 5. Example is a bad thing, because example spreads. There was a highly publicized Beirut hijacking of the TWA plane. After that hijacking, there was hijacking attempts at 9 different American airports. American airports. Pathological groups or individuals modeling on the others. Even more serious are examples set by governments. When governments engage in terror, they set very large. And when they engage in supporting terror, they engage in other sets of examples. 6. Absence of revolutionary ideology is central to victim terrorism. Revolutionaries do not commit unthinking terror. Those of you who are familiar with revolutionary theory know the debates, the disputes, the quarrels, the fights within revolutionary groups of Europe. The fight between anarchists and Marxists, for example. But the Marxists have always argued that revolutionary terror, if ever engaged in, must be sociologically and psychologically selective. Don't hijack a plane. Don't hold hostages. Don't kill children, for God's sake.
Police hurry to America's House of Representatives in Washington following an attack by 3 Puerto Ricans, including Rafael Miranda, who fired on the senators in the chamber. Fellow gunman Andres Condero and the woman member of the trio Lolita Lebron are hustled away from the menacing crowd. Firing more than 20 rounds from their Luger automatics, the 3 fanatics seriously wounded 5 senators.
Have you recalled also that the great revolutions, the Chinese, the Vietnamese, the Algerian, the Cuban, never engaged in hijacking type of terrorism. They did engage in terrorism, but it was highly selective. It was highly sociological. It was still deplorable, but there was an organized, highly limited, selective character to it. So absence of revolutionary ideology that begins more or less all of the post-World War II period has been central to this phenomenon. My final question with you is, but these conditions have existed for a long time, for a very, very long time. But why then this flurry of private political terrorism? Why now so much of it and so visible? And the answer is modern technology. It is a most and globalization. Look, modern terrorism, contemporary terrorism, frankly, is a class act. It's a class act. It's not a revolutionary act alone. It's a class act. You have got to have an international passport to do it. You better be speaking more than one language. It is in fact better if you are brown but have a blonde on your arms. So much the better, easier to pass the customs. The check posts, it's a class act. But it's modern travel, modern passport, modern guns, and most importantly, modern communication. You have a cause, you can communicate it through radio and television. They will all come swarming if you have taken an aircraft and you are holding 150 Americans hostages, and they will all hear your cause. You have a modern weapon through which you can shoot a mile away, they can't reach you, and you have the modern means of communicating. When they put together the cause, the instrument of coercion, and the instrument of communication, politics is made. A new kind of politics becomes possible. To this challenge, rulers from one country after another have been responding with traditional methods. The traditional method of shooting it out, whether it's missiles or some other means, shooting it out. And the Israelis are very proud of it. The Americans are very proud of it. The French became very proud of it. Now the Pakistanis are proud of it. The Pakistanis say our commandos are the best. Frankly, it won't work. The point proves a central problem of our time. Political minds rooted in the past and modern times producing new realities. Therefore, in conclusion, what is my recommendation to America? Quickly, without explaining them, you would know what I mean, what to do. First, avoid extremes of double standards. If you are going to practice double standards, you will be paid with double standards. Don't use it. Don't condone Israeli terror, Pakistani terror, Nicaraguan terror, El Salvador terror on the one hand, and then complain about Afghan terror, Pakistani terror, or Palestinian terror. Doesn't work. Try to be even-handed. A superpower cannot promote terror in one place and reasonably expect to discourage terrorism in another place. Won't work in this shrunken world. Second, 1A, or second, do not condone the terror of your allies. Condemn them. Fight them, punish them evenly. Third, please eschew, avoid covert operations and low-intensity warfare. Covert operations and low-intensity warfare are breeding ground of terror and drugs. Violence and drugs are bred there. The structure of covert operation And I made a film about it, which has been very popular in Europe, called Dealing with the Demon. What I have shown is, wherever covert operation has been, there has been the central drug problem. That has been also the center of drug trade, because the structure of covert operation, Afghanistan, Vietnam, Nicaragua, Central America, the structure of drug operation, covert operation, is very hospitable to drug trade. Avoid it, give it up, doesn't help. Fourthly, please focus on causes and help ameliorate causes. Even when you help or are perceived to help this little, it disappears. Palestinian terror has gone down. Not because the injustice is gone, but because perception developed that maybe something is happening with the peace process. This is a wrong perception. Terror will come back. But there is that perception. Try to look at causes and solve problems. 4. 5. Do not concentrate on military solutions. Do not seek military solution. Terrorism is a political problem. Seek political solutions. I can give you examples. Look, the only time the United States responded diplomatically and not militarily to a terrorist activity, i.e. hostage taking, was in Iran. They tried a little thing when Taba failed, stopped. Mostly engaged in diplomacy for 7 months. You know what they got? They got all the hostages back safe, and they got $6 billion in addition from the Iranians. It works. Diplomacy works. Military doesn't work. Take the example of the last attack on Bin Laden. Number one, you don't know what you're attacking. They say they know, they don't know. They attacked, they were trying to kill Gaddafi, right? They killed his 4-year-old daughter. That poor baby hadn't done anything. Gaddafi is still alive, mashallah. They tried to kill Saddam Hussein. They killed Laila bin Attar, an innocent woman. They tried to kill Bin Laden and his men. Not one died, 25 other people died. They tried to destroy a chemical factory in Sudan. Now they are admitting they destroyed a medicine factory. One half of the production of medicine in Sudan has been destroyed, not a chemical factory. You don't know. You think you know. You're going to hit the wrong thing all the time. You know, I'm the only one who ought to be happy about it. The Bin Laden thing. But I'm not very happy because I'm in opposition. Two of your missiles fell in Iran, in Pakistan. 4 fell in Pakistan. One was slightly damaged, 2 were totally damaged, 1 was slightly damaged, and 1 was totally intact. For 10 years, the American government has kept an embargo on Pakistan, because Pakistan is trying stupidly to build nuclear weapons and missiles. So we have a technology embargo on my country. One of the missiles was intact. And what do you think? The Pakistani official told the Washington Post, he said, it is the gift from Allah. They won't give us technology, and now we have got the technology, and our scientists are examining this missile very carefully. You see, fell into the wrong hands by American policy. So don't do that. Look for political solutions. Do not look for military solutions. They cause more problems than they solve. And 6, please help reinforce, strengthen the framework of international law. There was a criminal court in Rome. Why didn't they go to it first, get a warrant against Bin Laden if they have some evidence? Get a warrant, then go after him. enforce the United Nations, reinforce the International Court of Justice. This unilateralism just makes you look very, makes us look very stupid, and them relatively smaller. I think I've taken too much of your time. I am exactly 17 minutes ahead of the time given to me, and nobody said boo. So many thanks for bearing with me. My knowledge is...
It's extremely significant to me, at any rate, that you thought you knew something very well until you encountered Iqbal's view, and then you realized how, I won't say exactly conventional, but how there are so many things you didn't think about, which he... And I can do this best by reading you one more letter by Iqbal. But no, which bears on a contemporary issue, which is the question of Kosovo. I had leapt into print in late March about Kosovo and the NATO intervention, and in his rather gentle way, he wanted to indicate to me that I think that I had missed a few things, which I'm sure I had. Well, I knew I had. So here's what he said. Son of Palestine, moon over Jerusalem, light of the Semites, refuge of the world, shadow of the Lord on earth. A humble particle of dust offers salutations from down under your expensively dressed and glorious feet. And welcomes you back to the land of bombs and missiles, cold milk and canned honey. With deep interest and in humble submission, I read your stirring thoughts in Dawn, the newspaper that he had introduced me to, where I still write in Pakistan. I read your stirring thoughts in Dawn of Pakistan on the plight of Kosovo and the nefarious imperial intervention therein to advance its own purposes. Since in your wisdom and forbearance, you have forsaken your abject Batman, this glorious essay is the one, yours in other words, the one I wrote, is the one august sign I have of your return to the not-so-glorious belly of the beast. I enclose an abject effort on the subject, which, unfortunately, was written and dispatched before I could enlighten my dusty self and decorate my humble effort with a quotation or two from your brilliant observations. This is Iqbal at his ironic best. As always, with due respect and the humblest of submission, I remain Iqbal of no consequence. And he enclosed his article, which taught me a lot.